a nice little moment on the line last week where I was standing, observing, helping, and a student chef was ready to plate and a table, and they turned back to their rotisser and said, like, all they're missing is a piece of halibut. Rotis, how long on halibut? And I can see very clearly everything is ready for this order except the halibut. Rotis stands there, looks at the completely raw piece of halibut in front of them, looks at their cold pan, and responds, 2 minutes, chef. later on, we had a conversation about how it's more important that your estimated times be as accurate as possible than for you to just try and say that it'll just come as quickly.
Tell somebody what they want to hear.
Yeah, and it reminded me when at another kitchen I was working in, whenever I was working with the garde-manger, and no matter what was going on, when the chef asked how long on such and such from the app station, this guy would respond 2 minutes. And so I started making fun of him for it. I was like, there's no way you're saying 2 minutes every single time. But his was actually calculated. He said that if the chef hears what he doesn't want to hear, then service gets very difficult. And he'll, like, if he says 5 minutes, if he says 7 minutes or whatever, then chef is going to start giving him a hard time, coming to the station, asking why it's taking so long. But if he just says 2 minutes, even if it takes 5 minutes, the chef doesn't notice or something. I don't know.
Yeah, well, that exactly. It's a slippery slope situation now. Mm-hmm. Because, like, there's some truth to that, right? If you have, if you're working with someone who's volatile, and they and they absolutely can't handle hearing any bad news, and if you telling them that your component is going to be up like 3 minutes later than it should have been, and that's going to make them fly off the handle, that's going to slow down service. You know, like, they're going to come over to your station and they're going to spend 3 minutes like berating you, or they're going to spend 3 minutes where the food could be going in the window, like, you know, coming over and dismantling your station and telling you that it's not set up correctly and telling you that you don't listen or whatever. And so I can see why in certain circumstances it would make sense to just lie. But
yeah,
if things are functioning the way that they should, then, you know, you should be able to tell someone exactly how long it's going to take for your food to come to the window. And that should be like, that should be important information and, you know,
yes,
helpful information under most circumstances.
Yeah.
But yeah, I agree. And I think that that's the impression that people get from watching things like Hell's Kitchen and stuff like that too, is that you have to lie to the chef or you're going to get in trouble or something. Right.
But to me, the worst thing you could say is right away, chef.
Because, oh, man. Because it's not, because it contains no information, and it's just like, will you just shut up and leave me alone?
And it's almost certainly not true.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Welcome to Food Court. I'm Alan Sudeby, and I'm here with my co-host, Shail McDonald. Hi, Shail.
Hey, Alan.
We're two chefs in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. We love food, and we love to talk about it.
I like that word, co-host.
I knew
I feel like sometimes in my intro, I forget to say co-host. I say pal or friend or co-chef or something, but I got to remember to say co-host.
It's very,
that's the accurate information.
It's very co-host. Professional sounding. Yep.
We have any follow up today, Alan?
Was our last conversation?
What was the question
about the? Sorry, what? nope, no follow up from me.
Yeah, I don't think I have any real follow up either.
Well, then, what the heck are we going to talk about?
I don't know. That's a good question. Actually, I mean, I did mention I think that was at near the end of our last episode that I was like, oh yeah, actually I remember it took me like 5 minutes to tell you a 10 second thing.
Yep.
Because I explained how I went about finding out that I actually have some stolen menus as well.
Right.
But I'm not going to go back through that here. So,
oh, okay, good.
if you're really curious about how I found that I have actually some hidden away menus, some memento menus from meals that I had, you can go back and listen to the last episode.
The first 20 minutes of the last episode, yeah.
Was it the first 20 or the last 20? I think, I can't remember.
It was the first.
I get so disoriented after editing an episode because of the way in which I'm editing. Like, it kind of goes in chronological order. It mostly goes in chronological order, but I'm re-listening to things a bunch of times, mm-hmm. sort of in chronological order, and it makes it hard to remember the flow of the conversation.
Right.
It's actually really weird when I go back and listen to the conversation, like when I listen to the episode afterwards, which I usually do. I don't always, but I usually wind up with it in my podcast player, and then it just winds up playing while I'm in my vehicle one day or something, and I wind up listening to it because I get captivated. You're a talented speaker, Alan.
Oh, thanks.
But yeah, so I can never remember like when I said something or how something came up and stuff like that. It's always like really, I don't know, it's all broken up in my brain all the time.
Right, yeah.
But yeah, I found some menus. And I thought we could talk about them today. I don't know if it's going to be as effective. Like, they're kind of niche. So okay. I doubt that you're going to be able to, like, guess the restaurants or anything. Not mm-hmm. that I ever was able to guess any of the actual restaurants. Oh, wait. No, I did guess State Bird Provisions.
Yes. Yeah, totally.
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
But you also you ate that meal with me.
I ate the exact meal that you had there. Yeah. So that's kind of an unfair advantage. Mm-hmm. Yeah, anyway, I was just, I don't know, like, it's kind of neat looking back at these menus, and I was just going to kind of, like, go through them with you and see if I could make you jealous for having gotten to eat them. Mm-hmm. And
so they're bright.
Yeah, I don't know, maybe you can guess where they're situated or something like that. Mm-hmm. Actually, one of them, I feel like it won't be very hard to guess where it's situated at all. But yeah, we'll get to that. Also, this is kind of a piece of follow-up. But listener Spencer sent us in what looks to be a photograph of a physical copy of a menu from the Chicago World's Fair. And when was that, Alan? 18.
So his note says that this is a vintage menu from a book that's about the Chicago World's Fair circa
1893. Mm-hmm. So yeah, maybe if we have time, we'll go through that menu too and comment on it. Looks interesting. Whole thing's in French.
Yes.
I guess that was back when Chicago was a French town.
It was, that's just all fancy menus from the 19th century are French.
If they weren't in French, they weren't in fancy.
Yeah. In the West. I'm sure that the menus in China probably weren't in French, but.
That's a good point. Although I wonder how far back, it seems like when I was in Japan, French food is like pretty, I don't know. There's a lot of, there's like a whole cookware street, and there's like a giant statue on top of a building of a French chef at the front of that street.
A particular French chef?
Kapabashi. What's that?
A particular French chef?
I don't think it's anyone in particular. I wasn't able to recognize them if it is, and I never found any information saying that it is a specific French chef. I think it's just like kind of a generic French chef, mm-hmm. but they're wearing like very French chef-y uniform and stuff. So there's a thing in Japanese culture about fancy food being French as well. Mm-hmm. And so I wonder if there are like, you know, if there were French restaurants in Japan in the 1800s that were fancy. I have no idea. I'm curious to try to dive into that. Listener, if you have any ideas. Yeah, so why don't we just jump right in?
Do it.
I'll just start reading you dishes off this first menu.
Okay.
And maybe you can let me know if you can figure out where you think the menu might be from regionally.
Okay.
And then afterwards I can tell you where it's actually from and try and give you a little bit of context about my meal there and stuff.
You mean guess which region of Edmonton it's from? Is that what you're talking about?
I'll give you a big hint by saying that it's not from Edmonton.
Okay.
And I believe I had everything on this menu.
Whoa.
Yeah, I don't think that there was anything on this menu that was like a choice. I think I had everything that was on it.
Mm-hmm.
And also there's no pricing on it, which is a pretty good indication that that was the case.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly not an a la carte menu.
Okay.
Okay. So the first item, which seems weird to me, but actually, you know what? I'm going to skip the first item because it's a dead giveaway for regionality.
Okay.
So the first item has a weird name, though. So don't let me forget to go back to it because I want to talk about that.
Okay.
Okay. So then the second item is snow cone, and it has plum ice and epazote. Then we've got chilled spiced eggplant soup with pole beans and nepotella.
Nepotella.
Yeah.
Are you trying to say Nutella?
That's not how it's spelled on the menu.
Oh, okay.
But I actually don't know what nepotella is.
Me neither.
Might require a little bit of Googling later on. And then I had sturgeon caviar, egg yolk poached in smoked oil, creme fraiche, and chive.
Mm-hmm.
Next course was a seared spot prawn with fermented carrot, cucumber, and opal basil. And each one of these, well, the first four came with, like, I think they were snacks, and they came with a wine.
Mm-hmm.
They came with champagne, actually. And then the seared spot prawn came with an Italian wine. I don't even know how to pronounce it.
Okay.
Alto Adige?
Yeah, Alto Adige, yep.
Yeah. Next course was cherry tomatoes, puree of grilled zucchini and wheatgrass, green olive oil, herbs, and flowers. It came with a Spanish wine.
Mm-hmm.
Then we had Andante fresh buffalo milk cheese, beet, endive, honey, tarragon, flowers.
Mm-hmm.
It came with a German Riesling. Then we had Wild King salmon cooked over lemon leaf,
mm-hmm.
spring vegetables, flowering cilantro. Flowering cilantro. That's mm-hmm. interesting. And that came with a Slovenian Pinot Gris.
Okay.
Which is interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I don't specifically remember if I remarked about that at the time. But man, I loved Slovenia when I was there, and I was there before I had this mm-hmm. meal. So
mm-hmm. yeah, there's some really good Slovenian wines. Even in Edmonton, you can get some good Slovenian wines.
That's cool.
Producer Batiche is usually available. Yeah.
Sweet. Available at lots of places or
at boutiques like say Color de Vino carried it when I worked there, but
sweet. Then I had popcorn grits. If there's
yeah, you did. It's funny. Go on.
Okay, great. That's nice. That's good to know. Then I had steamed morel potato dumplings, braised lettuce, green garlic, and thyme. And that came with a Californian chard.
Mm-hmm.
Then I had Hollander Farm pigeon grilled over charcoal, shiokoji, mm-hmm. cherry blossom, pickled cherries. And that came with a French burgundy. And then it looks like sweet courses after that.
Mm-hmm.
So coconut mochi bun with
Yum.
Kiwi and shiso. Then glazed strawberries. Black sesame licorice, sweet herb sorbet, mm-hmm. which came with, a Jura Son from France.
Yeah, so that's from...
So from Jura, I assume.
No, actually, Jura Son is different than Jura.
Oh, interesting.
Jura Son is in the very southwest part of the country, tucked up against the Pyrenees.
Oh, cool.
Whereas the Jura is over on the east side, adjacent to the Alps, kind of.
Right. But you also get some... like late harvest wines and stuff in Jura, is that correct? Or
Definitely. It's most like abroad, it's most famous for making vin jaune, which is like an oxidized right. style of wine that's aged under floor, almost like, not really the same thing, but akin to sherry, kind of.
Right, okay. Yeah. And then blueberries and violet with vanilla cake, whipped fromage blanc. And that came with another French wine from Loire, which mm-hmm. I imagine was probably like a sweet wine, like a late harvest wine. Mm-hmm. And then frozen dark chocolate and yuzu marshmallow, mm-hmm. which I think was like a petit four.
Yum.
And that was the whole menu. And I ate this menu on the 6th of June in 2014.
Mm-hmm. Were you in San Francisco?
I was in San Francisco. Good job, Alan.
So the flavor combinations and the wine pairings sound so, like, I know that this is not the place, but they're very similar. The inventiveness and drawing from the East, the West, reminds me of State Bird Provisions, like right. to have, let's say, plum, like whatever the, first of all, the playful name Snow Cone puts us in America, but then you have Plum Ice and Epizote. So it's like this really interesting fusion. You see it again with like the, what you said, strawberries and black sesame, this kind of playfulness, yeah. inventiveness. I think of State Bird Provisions, but the popcorn grits is actually, to me, we'll see if I'm wrong, but that's actually a giveaway, because that's a dish that Daniel Patterson made on Mind of a Chef. And so
that's interesting. Right. No, yeah, that's right. I remember that episode now. And I wonder, I can't remember if that show, I thought that show came out afterwards.
I actually don't know what years it was produced.
Yeah, I don't know either.
So I'm going to say.
But I do remember seeing that.
Yeah. So I'm going to say this is a, okay, maybe I don't say that. It's spelled like koi, but is it qua? C-O-I?
Yeah, I think it's qua.
Qua.
Yeah.
Yeah. So is this.
I'm not positive.
Is this a menu from qua?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. It sounds awesome.
Good job. Wow, Alan, I'm impressed. I mean, it's not entirely obscure. And yeah, Daniel Patterson is not like an unknown chef or anything. He's a very famous chef. But it's like not on the same level as something like, you know, like
Thomas Keller, René Redzepi. Yeah.
Yeah, in terms of you know, like how much people would have, you know, known, yeah, like the French Laundry or something like that, you know, like it's mm-hmm. in terms of renown in the general culture, it's much less, I think, probably well known than like a restaurant that's on the level of like a Noma or something like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and even the wine pairings, to me, like, because they're so international, that also. And niche, like to have something like a Jurançon, like
yeah.
it means, I don't know what the wine pairings are like at Noma, where it's not a wine producing region, but if you're in
right.
France or Italy, usually depends on the kind of theme of the restaurant. But like, if, for instance, if you eat at Osteria Francescana, all of the wines are from around Modena and Emilia Romagna. And if you right. ate at Michel Bras restaurant in the south of France, I'm sure that they would be drawing wines from there. But these ones are like deep cuts from all over the world.
Totally.
And that makes me think that it's, yeah, a place like obviously you can do that in London, England, or Paris, France. But like, yeah, I think of San Francisco and New York and the new world. Yeah, that menu sounds awesome, though. I was surprised.
Yeah.
One way that it's a little bit different than State Bird, for example, is that there was some like luxury ingredients, like there was sturgeon caviar, and was there any?
Yeah.
Maybe that was the only one, actually. Was there anything else that stood out as a luxury ingredient?
I mean, I don't think that there's anything else on here that you couldn't at one time or another, you know, wind up running into at a restaurant like State Bird. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let me see. Was something else. Oh well, pigeon, I think, like, you know, you'd be it would I feel like it would be pretty rare to run it like it's not a luxury ingredient, maybe in terms of like its price point or mm-hmm. something like that, but to get well-raised pigeons is probably not easy. They're probably few and far between, and mm-hmm. and so they're probably relatively pricey, and you just don't see them on a lot of menus, because I don't know, people have a aversion to it or something like that.
Well, that's why you call it squab.
I mean, yeah, that's why it is often called squab, yeah. Which, like, honestly, if I had to tell just from the name if something was something that I wanted to eat or not, and you told me I could have pigeon or squab, and I had no cultural context for what either of those things were, I'd probably choose pigeon.
Yeah.
Squab sounds kind of nasty. I don't know why.
Yeah, that's
just the
true.
Sound of the even... word.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, and then the thing that I skipped at the beginning, which is the very first snack on the menu, is a California bowl, which is
oh, okay.
Why I didn't want to say it.
What is a California bowl?
I don't remember.
Like it's a
unfortunately.
Like a rice
There's
bowl?
A lot of stuff it. On this menu that I don't really remember the context for, and I don't even have like a very good picture of what it looked like in my head. Some of them, as I was going through and reading them, I was like, oh yeah. Mm-hmm. And I actually do have pictures, I believe, of a lot of these dishes. And so I can make sure that some of that stuff gets posted on the Instagram after we release this episode. But yeah, there's a lot of stuff that I don't really remember at all. But I know that I had heard of and seen something about the popcorn grits
right
before I went. And so I was excited to try that, and it didn't disappoint. It was really good.
Cool.
Yeah.
The only other ingredient that stood out to me as like maybe a regional specialty that wouldn't be seen much farther away was the spot prawn. Like, like for Canadians, if you hear spot prawn, you immediately think of British Columbia. And so I was like, this must be on the North American West Coast somewhere, but maybe right. It's much more widely available. But
yeah, I don't know. It's interesting because like, I think there's this phenomenon where like you'll have a regional ingredient that will gain popularity in like higher end restaurants because it's like, because it's regional and because it's from the area, because it's local, you know, you can do a really good job of promoting it in restaurants where you actually can get it locally. Mm-hmm. And then the quality of it also, because you can get it locally, is usually better because you're not shipping it for a week somewhere else or whatever. Right. Mm-hmm. But then as like that ingredient starts to gain popularity in that region because it's easy to market and because it's high quality, first what happens is like other restaurants or other food service organizations in the region will start to use its popularity to try and help bolster their marketing by saying that they have that product or saying that it's, you know, spot prawn season or something right. like that. And then that's when everyone eats spot prawns and suddenly you can get spot prawns at Earl's.
Right.
And then Earl's realizes that people have heard of spot prawns and that they're like prestigious. I wonder if people have heard of spot prawns somewhere else, and so they'll roll out spot prawns on their menu like in Alberta, say. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly you've got a whole bunch of people in Alberta who understand that spot prawns are special or something, but now you're also shipping spot prawns to Alberta. And then at some point there's usually like this line that gets crossed where you can say that something is spot prawns but it's not actually spot prawns. And then like you can you call it spot prawns with a Z and suddenly it doesn't have to actually be spot prawns anymore. You know, like in the same way that like Cheese Whiz doesn't actually have to be cheese or something. And so I wonder if like, you know, I wonder if spot prawns have some like cachet in their marketing in other places in North America now, whether you can actually supply enough spot prawns to like give everyone spot prawns in North America, or whether now it's just like a lie, whether you're getting spot prawns or not. I don't know.
Well, we've actually sort of talked about this where I tried to put spot prawns on a menu, but all that we could procure reliably, because they weren't in season, but I thought maybe you could procure high quality ones that had been frozen.
Had been frozen in block or something.
Yeah, and we ended up the first product that I got was from Alaska, and the quality was so bad. Like, they were just like complete mush, discolored. Yeah, and so we just immediately abandoned the idea and said, sorry, I should have just, I'm not in BC. It's not the season. My bad. I'll serve beef or something. But
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. See, that's interesting. But I feel like, I mean, don't start blushing, Alan, but I feel like you have a lot of integrity in how you put together a menu and the food that you put on it and the verbiage and the way that you design a menu in terms of its like the local nature of it or where the ingredients come from. And you're very thoughtful about that kind of thing. I feel like there are a lot of chefs who would be like, yeah, we're going to put spot prawns on the menu. Or an owner would go to a chef and be like, hey, we need to put spot prawns on the menu. And the chef would be like, okay, I'll get some spot prawns. And then they get them in and they're terrible. And they would be like, ah, we should just use like the tiger prawns that I've been getting from Vietnam for the last 7 years or whatever and call them spot prawns. And then they would just do that. Like anyone that thinks that that wouldn't happen, I'm sorry to disillusion you, but yeah,
right.
I feel like it's probably fairly common for things to be called something that they aren't on restaurant menus.
Yeah, that sounds like an episode.
Yeah, okay. I don't want to totally derail us. Do you want me to go through and like tell you about things that I do kind of remember?
Yeah, sure. Any standouts or anything? Yeah.
Yeah. I don't remember what the California Bowl was, so that's weird, and I don't know. If I have a picture of that, I'll definitely post it with a comment. Saying, oh yeah, now I remember. This snow cone, plum ice with epazote. I actually don't remember what epazote is. Alan, do you know?
Yeah, it's a herb that's really common in Mexican cooking. And it's usually paired with beans, I think. Like stewed beans and refried beans would have epazote in it, I think.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, because that was my guess, because I do have a sort of like memory of how this dish looked when it came, and it was like it was like a rounded bit of granite in the bottom of a bowl with herbs on top.
And so this is not I remember we did a dinner at Little Brick, you, me, and Erica, and you did a plum dish that had ice on it, but that's not the origin of this.
Oh, that's interesting.
But it yours wasn't a snow cone. It wasn't shaved ice. It was like a sheet of ice with thyme in it or something.
Huh.
Do you remember that? No?
I don't remember that. That sounds really interesting though, Alan. It sounds like an idea that I would have, and it sounds really interesting. But yeah, I don't remember doing that.
That's so crazy to me that you don't, because it's such a, you had this vision. It was, all I remember is it was plum and thyme. And you somehow used oil to like make you floated water on oil and then froze that so that you could pop the frozen sheet of water off the oil or something.
Yeah, well, water would sink in oil, so I don't know, but that probably wasn't it. But yeah, something. Yeah, like it's ringing a bell, or maybe I just like put a pan of water in the freezer until the top layer froze or something like that. I don't know. Can't remember, but.
Okay. Well, maybe Erica remembers. I don't know.
Maybe. Sorry. I don't remember my own dish. That happens to me a lot. And then I don't always take pictures, although I do usually have menus kicking around somewhere, like in some like backlog of my email or something. Like every event that I've done, I'm sure I have like drafts of the menu because they've got like emailed back and forth and stuff like that. But
well, if you or anyone else has the reserved documents from Elm Catering, I happen to remember the client's name and I can give it to you.
Oh, really?
Yeah, for real. Yeah.
Okay. So let's not forget to do that offline because I will look it up.
You don't remember the dish at all. I remember the client's name, Shill.
Yeah, I know. It's shocking. I have a terrible memory. I mean, in some ways. It's funny. Like, the things that I'll remember sometimes are, like, shockingly, like, I'm just shocked that I can remember them. But I don't know. I think that's sort of, Well, I don't want to say that everyone's memory works that way. I definitely know that, like, my sister, for instance, has a better memory than I do just for, like, details of things in general that we did, you know? Like, mm-hmm. I'll remember a single detail from something that we did, but she'll remember, like, a lot of right. the details. And I'm just always like, man, yeah, I don't have access to my memories like that. Like, for instance, I remember you and Erica and I doing an event together. I remember some of the food from that event. I remember, like, talking to Erica about some of the preparations that we were going to do. And, you know, like, yeah. And I think I remember a dish that you did. Was it a carrot dish? Did you do a carrot dish on that menu? You don't remember?
Well, I don't remember because I didn't do a carrot dish, but
oh, okay.
I'm just kidding. Not. I don't actually know. I remember Erica did a dish that was like, there was an egg yolk and then there was like a milk skin covering it. So it looked like a poached egg, but it was not an egg, or it wasn't an egg white. And I know that I did a tortelloni dish, like squash filled tortelloni with hazelnuts and sage. I wasn't allergic to hazelnuts at the time.
Oh, and, yeah. And you yeah. didn't think you were.
Yeah. Oh, and we did okay. the, we did the, I think it was Erica had had this cheese dish from Toque in Montreal, yes. right? And we did it with Grizzly Gouda. It's like shards of Grizzly Gouda, unsweetened soft whipped cream and crispy meringue.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember the crispy meringue pretty specifically because mm-hmm. I think it was something that I had done before and that maybe she hadn't or something like that. Mm-hmm. So we talked about it.
Anyways.
Back to the qua menu. So yeah, the snow cone I kind of remember. Chilled spiced eggplant soup. I don't remember that. I don't really remember eating the caviar.
What a shame.
Maybe I kind of do. So yeah, it seems like a shame, right? I do remember a couple of caviar experiences that I've had. One of them was in Portland. We went to a Russian restaurant. Mm-hmm. Myself and the managers and owners of Kind, we had like a management retreat in Portland mm-hmm. one year mm-hmm. and we went to a Russian restaurant which Kachka. I believe is called Kachka, and yeah, we had a bunch of caviar there because mm-hmm. It's just sort of the thing that you do mm-hmm. when you go to a Russian restaurant. Like caviar is very popular in Russia. A lot of caviar comes from Russia, so mm-hmm. So yeah, we had like it wasn't a crazy amount for the group of people that we had, but we definitely indulged in caviar while we were there. And I remember that was pretty epic. Mm-hmm. Okay. And then there's the seared spot prawn. Trying to remember fermented carrot, cucumber, opal basil. I think I have kind of like a visual memory of this, but I think I have a picture of it too. So I don't have, I can remember when I ate this, where I was sitting in the restaurant. I was sitting at a table by myself because I basically like showed up in San Francisco and just tried to get reservations at restaurants that I wanted to go to. I think while I was in San Francisco at this time, I also went to State Bird Provisions. And I think this was the first time that I was in San Francisco. And I think I went to State Bird. Oh, I went to State Bird with another person from Edmonton that I ran into on the plane who also works in the food service industry.
Oh, really?
And we hung out a whole bunch. We went to a bunch of restaurants. We went to Mission Chinese together. Mm-hmm. We went to State Bird together. I think actually that I got the recommendation. I think that he already had a reservation at State Bird and kind of asked me if I wanted to come along. And I was like, sure. Mm-hmm. And then we went there and it was like amazing and eye-opening. And I was like, oh my God, this is one of my favorite restaurants ever. And so then I think I like evangelized it to everyone when I got back,
right.
Which is one of the reasons why we wound up going there, I think, when we went together. Mm-hmm. I have a pretty good memory of like where I sat in the dining room, what the dining room looked like. When I called to make my reservation, they were booked up. I wasn't going to be able to get a reservation, mm-hmm. but I kind of begged them a little bit on the phone. I was like,
That works.
Hey, look, I'm a chef from Canada. I'm really a big fan of Daniel Patterson. I really would like the opportunity to try his food. I'm not in town very often. It's going to be very difficult for me to come back and have a meal at the restaurant. If there's any way that you can fit me in the next couple of days, that would be awesome. I'm just a single diner. You can put me anywhere. I'll sit on the floor in the kitchen. I don't care. I think when I first got there, I called, or maybe I called like the day before I left or something, just to see if it was going to be possible. And I think they basically gave me a no, but I gave them my phone number and I was like, hey, if anything opens up, please call. I will make time to come there. Like, doesn't matter what time the reservation is, doesn't matter what day it is, like, I'll figure it out. And they did call and they said that they had room for one diner on one of the nights that I was there. And I was like, oh man, that's so awesome. Thank you very much. But then because it's a really nice restaurant, they make a special effort for every guest. You know, it's like in The Bear where they like research their guests and they, you know, do something special for people, and returning guests get special treatment and they get the menu changed if they've eaten the menu too many times and that kind of thing. Like, you know, it's a really high end experience. And so because I told them on the phone that I was a chef and that I was a fan of Daniel and stuff like that, they really like laid into the service and they really laid into like explaining where everything came from and answering my questions. And then Daniel Patterson came out like twice during the service and talked to me about the food. Wow. And cool. He came out at the beginning of the service and thanked me for coming. And I was like, thanks for coming and talking to me. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you don't have a lot of time in your schedule. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it was really special. And I remember, like, you know, I remember, it's like we talked about before, like, you remember the experience of having the meal. You don't necessarily remember the experience of eating every dish unless that dish, like, really changed your mind about something or really hit on a very specific, like, sense memory or something like that.
Right. Well, that's awesome. I knew that you had dined there. I didn't know that that was that you were on your hands and knees begging them to let you in the door and that you got to talk to Daniel Patterson and stuff. That's cool.
I've actually, like, for going to like really high end restaurants, a lot of my experiences are that way.
You have to beg? Is that what you mean?
Yeah.
The power. Yeah. I'm picturing the Shale autobiography is just called like The Power of Begging
Yeah, seriously. It's, I mean, my philosophy around that, I think, is that, like, it never hurts to ask.
Yes.
You know, like, I think that, yeah, probably a lot of people would be shy about calling and asking.
Right.
If they couldn't get a reservation, like, through the website or through the normal means or something like that. Mm-hmm. And a lot of restaurants, it's just not an option to call and ask. Like, they answer the phone once a month. Or something, right. You know, like, like if you want to beg, you have to go there, which I think I have done. I'm trying to remember. I do remember one. And that was tickets in Barcelona.
Right.
There was no way for me to contact them. I was in town for 3 days and there was only one day that the restaurant was open while I was there. There was no way to call. There was just nobody answering the phone the first 2 days that I was in Barcelona because the restaurant was closed. And they just don't answer the phone on days that the restaurant is closed.
Right.
And so I had to, if I wanted to be able to eat there, which I really wanted to do, the only way that I was going to be able to get in is if I went on the day that they were actually open and went to the restaurant and tried to talk to someone. Yep. And so I found out what time the restaurant like opens, which I think it only opened for dinner at the time that I was there. I'm not sure. Don't exactly remember. But I remember like I went, maybe there was some indication on their website of like when they start answering the phone or something like that. I can't remember. But I went like on the day that they were going to be open, I went like early in the morning. I went at like 9 a.m. or something and just waited for like chefs and service people to start showing up. And I was just like hanging out outside the restaurant door. And I was like,
in the alley.
Hey, I'm just kidding. Do you speak English? Which a lot of the people who worked there did not. But yeah, I just basically hung out outside the restaurant until I could figure out a way to, you know, without, you know, trying to like get in the way of people getting in the restaurant to do their jobs, but just like politely asking if there was somebody that I could talk to about potentially getting a reservation. And then I did, I think like it was a sometime around like 10:30 or 11 in the morning. I was able to talk to someone and they were, you know, they said that, yeah, if I came by like right when the restaurant opened, that they would be able to find a single seat for me. Mm-hmm. And then they did. And I had an amazing meal there. But yeah, a lot of my experiences are like that.
It's also a good way to get a job. What you just described, just hanging out outside and talking.
It is.
Waiting until you see employees walk in and asking if you can talk to someone.
Yeah. Yeah. It definitely shows like eagerness. If you do that, like it shows that you're really interested in trying to work there. Mm-hmm. It can also be fruitless if they aren't looking for anyone or you show up on the wrong day. If you like, you know, go every day for a few weeks or whatever, you probably stand a pretty good chance. But
if you go every day for a few weeks, yeah. If you linger in the service entrance for 30 days, then yeah.
Yeah, they're just like, fine.
Yeah. There's stories like that.
We're not going to be able to get you to leave. We'll just give you a job. Okay, I'll finish this quaw thing. I'll just go through. So the Andante Fresh Buffalo Milk Cheese. Unfortunately, I don't really remember eating that. Wild King Salmon cooked over lemon leaf. I don't have a super like specific memory of that either. The popcorn grits, I definitely remember exactly what the dish was like. And I think I'd seen it in magazines and stuff before and was aware of how they made it and stuff. So that was really cool getting to try it. Steamed morel potato dumpling. I do remember eating this. I think it was kind of pierogi-like, if I'm remembering correctly.
Oh, yeah.
And then the pigeon. Maybe I remember. I think maybe it was like a breast and a leg or something, if I'm remembering correctly. I'm pretty sure I have a picture of it, so I should be able to pull that out. Coconut mochi bun, I don't remember very well. The glazed strawberries, I do remember. Yeah. Black sesame licorice, though, was on this dish, and I don't exactly remember how that was a part of it, but I think the glazed strawberries were laid over top of a sorbet. There's a sweet herb sorbet on here, so I think I'm remembering that right. And then blueberries and violet. I don't exactly remember, but if the blueberries were a gel, then I kind of remember, maybe. And then the frozen dark chocolate and yuzu marshmallow. I don't specifically remember, but yeah, it's possible that I have a photo. So yeah, I guess I really remember the experience. I even remember walking to the restaurant. I remember like because it's like it was kind of in the, and this restaurant is closed now, unfortunately. I'm not exactly sure what Daniel Patterson's doing now. I have seen a few things recently like online about stuff that he's been doing, but I'm pretty sure that this restaurant closed during COVID and never reopened.
I think
so. That's kind of sad. But I have this menu to remember it by, so that's nice.
Cool.
Yeah, and a bunch of photos, which I will try to post on Instagram. In fact, I think like on my personal Instagram, if you go way back, there's probably photos of this meal on my actual Instagram feed. So yeah, that was really nice. And I think like, man, yeah, that first time I went to San Francisco, it was basically just my intention to eat. And that's basically all I did. And honestly, I had some like some really distressingly full days of eating where I was just like ate way too much food and couldn't really sleep properly because I ate too much and like had like five like big meals in a day. We'd have like a big meal for lunch and then we'd go for a big meal for dinner. And I was just like, yeah, that was kind of sad because like I wanted to eat everything, but you couldn't even eat like a small amount of everything that I wanted to eat and still not like eat way too much food during a day.
Yes.
So yeah, now I have to be a little more restrained when I go on like a food travel vacation.
The worst example of that for me was, did you know that I've been to France, Shil? Did you know that about me, that I've been to France?
Have you seen the, never mind. Yeah.
But I've only been there for one day.
Okay, yes, I did know this about you.
So I was staying in Switzerland with a family friend in Basel, which is very, very close to France. And so we did a one-day excursion into Alsace and visited the city of Colmar. And I was like, I'm in France for the first time in my life. I have no idea when I will be back here. And it was like Alsatian food is like, because of the German influence and everything, like it's something that I love and had read loads about. And I was like, okay, in the next 10 hours, I have to eat every single classic Alsatian dish. And it's not a light cuisine. It's like even one like choucroute garni, like that you should be able to eat. And then you don't eat anything else for days. It's a heavy cuisine, but I made a go of it. It was not easy, but I ate.
Yeah, my first day ever in France was also in Alsace, in Strasbourg.
Oh, really? Yeah.
And I was going to be in France for a little while, so I didn't feel that pressure. But there were, like, I think I've told this story on the podcast before, but, like, that was the first time I ever went into a French cheese shop.
Right.
And I went in. There was all this amazing cheese. My eyes were popping out of my head, but I had a pretty tight budget because I was trying to eat like at these nice restaurants and I didn't have a ton of money. So I had to be relatively conservative about, you know, what I spent on food on my like days that I wasn't going to have a restaurant meal or something. Mm-hmm. And, but like one of the first places that we went into was a cheese shop and I was like, okay, well, I'm in France for the very first time. I can buy a little bit of cheese at the cheese shop, right? So I picked out a couple things and told them the weights that I wanted. And then I went to the till to pay for it. And I don't know why I was expecting that it was going to be a lot because the prices were on things. Mm-hmm. But I just like, I don't know. I was a little bit like in a floaty dream state and not really thinking all that clearly and not paying that much attention to the pricing or whatever. But I picked out a couple things, sort of like I would in a cheese shop in Edmonton, like a couple hundred grams of this and 100 grams of that. And like, I was like, okay, this is going to be like, you know, 15 euro or something. Mm-hmm. And I went to the till and it was like 1.50 euro or something like that. And I was like, oh, okay. So then I bought a bunch more stuff and then we went and found a baguette and then we had a picnic in the park with like a bunch of amazing cheese and a really amazing bottle of Alsatian wine that we probably got for like 6 euro and like, yeah, yeah, it's awesome. Mm-hmm. You can get really good food for cheap in France if you aren't eating at fancy restaurants all the time.
Right.
And really great wine. Like really amazing wine that here would be like specialty wine and it would be like $30-35 a bottle or something like that. There it's like 7 euro or something like that in a lot of cases. I don't know. That may have changed. It was a while ago that I was in France, but I imagine it's still similar. Seems like it would be an expensive place to travel and accommodations are relatively pricey and stuff like that. Like in most of Europe, but like in a lot of places in Europe, it's not that expensive to get really good food. Okay, well, I don't know, Alan. Do we have time? You know what? I think I'm going to say I have a couple other stolen menus here, but I think maybe I'll save them up for another episode. But okay. I kind of want to walk through this menu that Spencer sent us on Instagram because I only got like a quick second to sort of like take a look at it. But I feel like it fits the topic, and I'm really curious to kind of like look into it.
Okay. How's your French these days?
I guess we're about to find out. But if it gets really rough, I'll contact Google or ChatGPT. So I don't have the text in front of me that Spencer posted when he sent us this menu because I can't access our food court Instagram account right now. But this is a menu ostensibly from the World's Fair in Chicago in 1893. Is that what you said?
That's what he said. Yep.
Okay. And is that all of the context that we have for it?
That's it. Yep.
Yeah. You said it, but it's like a picture out of like a cookbook or a magazine or something like that.
It's a book about that World's Fair. Okay. And this is a menu that's printed in that book that he took a picture of and sent to us.
Cool. Okay. So first thing on the menu, and it looks like there's like a food and a wine for every course here is what it looks like. And
yeah,
it looks like there
are not quite every course, but yes.
Just about every course there's a separate wine. So that seems pretty, I mean, like that's pretty modern fine dining to have like a wine pairing for every course.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe modern's not the right word. Okay, I'm going to count how many courses there are too. 1, 2, 9 courses, 10 if you count cheese and coffee. Something like that?
I do count 10 or cheese. 11? Yeah. Yeah. 10.
Okay. So first course is bleu poin à l'Alaska.
I would say blue points.
yeah, you're right. Blue points. Yeah. So what? These are oysters, right?
Yeah. And I don't know what à l'Alaska, like, does that mean? Like blue points don't come from Alaska, but do they mean it's prepared in the Alaskan style?
No, so this is probably a preparation, right?
And I have no idea what that means.
Yeah, but it's probably that they're cooked in some way with some kind of topping on them.
Yeah, possibly.
Good question.
Not sure. But they're served with sauterne, which is really interesting to me to start a meal. Well, I guess there are other like classical pairings with sauterne that are kind of like salty, like foie gras and stuff like that, so... But yeah, I've never had oysters and sauterne before.
Yeah, that's interesting. I'm gonna allay my temptation to Google what à l'Alaska means.
Okay.
Okay, next we have the soup course. Potage, it says on the menu.
Mm-hmm.
That's French for soup course.
Yep.
And the soup course is consommé printanier.
Mm-hmm.
Crème de céleri.
So a springtime consommé.
Springtime consommé with cream of celery. So yeah. I don't know, or is that like, I wonder, is it like consommé is the soup and then it has like a cream garnish, a celery cream garnish? Is it like those two things mixed together? I just can't imagine.
Yeah, when I see...
I feel like a modern interpretation of something like this would be like you would find a way to like have the cream on the bottom or something, and then you would like float consommé on top of it, but it would be this like really clear consommé, and then when you eat it, it would like, I don't know.
Mm-hmm. I wonder...
Come together or something.
Surely like there's just a really obvious answer that you could look up in Escoffier. I wonder though if crème de céleri is like if it's a royale or something, like it's creamed celery like set like a royale and floated in the consommé, but
floated, right?
It's
yeah,
it's hard
quite
for
possibly.
Me to imagine.
Yeah, and then it's served with amontillado sherry. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's interesting. I like that.
So that's interesting. Yeah.
And I'm assuming
sauterne is generally like fairly sweet.
It's very sweet. Like it's fully fully sweet to lusciously sweet.
Right. And so, then amontillado is also for sherry, fairly sweet.
So like a true amontillado would be dry, because if it were sweetened, usually we would call that a cream sherry.
Okay.
So I don't know if they use different vernacular at this time, but a true amontillado would be dry.
Would be dry. Okay.
But partly oxidized and kind of have medium body. But yeah, it's an interesting pairing because soup, I don't know, pairing with soup is always a challenge. So
yeah, it's tricky. Yeah. And then we've got the hors d'oeuvre course. Rissol Chateaubriand, Amande Salé, Olive, etc.
And the rest. Yeah.
And yeah. the rest. So Rissol Chateaubriand, I don't exactly know what that is.
So for in culinary school, like a rissolé is just a way of cutting potatoes. And usually, okay. usually Chateaubriand is referring to a piece of the beef tenderloin, but I don't think that's what it is here.
No. Yeah.
So I don't know actually what they're referring to, but,
yeah. So maybe it's a specific potato preparation or something like that.
Yeah, that would make sense. And then with an almond salad and olives, I don't know. That sounds nice. Sounds
this is actually salted almonds. Salé.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay. Yeah. yeah.
Salé would be salted. So salted almonds, olives. And so it's kind of sounds like a little bit of a charcuterie board maybe or something like that.
I don't know. That to me, sherry would go well with that too. it's
yeah.
potatoes, almonds, and olives, but...
Well, it looks like that sherry is like meant to go with this course as well, because there isn't actually a wine for this course. So that kind of makes sense. So you would get the sherry with your soup, but then you would drink it for these two courses, the soup and then this course as well. The hors d'oeuvre.
Maybe. Yeah, I'm not sure.
Maybe. next course is fish, poisson. And it is basse raillée, sauce hollandaise, pomme parisienne.
So you got your basse.
Yeah, we got your striped bass.
Your hollandaise.
We've got your hollandaise sauce. And we've got Parisians of potato.
Yeah.
Yeah, sounds pretty traditional.
And it's coming to you with champagne. Multiple different
right.
kinds of champagne. Moët,
yeah,
Chandon.
Two different kinds of champagne?
Perrier,
is that right?
Jouet. Part of the first one's cut off. I think there's three, though. Like this, the first one is cut off for me, but it looks like it's Mère Finet. And then a Moët Chandon. Perrier Jouet. So I don't know. Everyone's getting three glasses of champagne. That sounds nice.
It sounds great. Then we have the next course, which is called Refève, which I've never actually seen that before. Do you know what that is, Alan?
Well, so usually at this point in an Escoffier menu, the course would be called the Relève, like with an L, not an F. So I don't know if there's different vernacular or if somehow
it's a typo. Yeah.
But usually, if I remember right, the Relève would be like an individually cut, a small individual portion of meat that's cut before it's cooked. Whereas the rôti, the roast, is like a big roast that is carved at the table.
Right.
And I don't know if, like I said, if this is a just different vernacular or if somehow it's a typo.
Yeah, and it's a little bit cut off in the picture here. So but I can't exactly see what cut of beef it is, but it is beef with mushrooms.
Yeah, we know that the first word ends in a T, so it could be filet de bœuf.
Au
champignon,
yeah.
But I don't know. Haricot vert.
Yeah, that's probably what it is.
And pomme duchesse. So we got a little beefsteak with mushrooms and green beans and duchesse potatoes. Lovely.
Yeah, sounds great. Then we have the entree, which is riz de veau en côtelette and petit pois. So green peas and riz de veau. Is that a stew?
No, it's sweetbreads.
Oh, it's right. Sweetbreads.
So like a cutlet of veal sweetbreads with little peas. Sounds fantastic.
Sounds amazing. And I guess so there's no wine listed for the beef or the veal sweetbreads.
I'm going to go out. There's a wine that's listed a few courses down. And I'm going to assume that wine is served with the Refève, entrée, sorbet, and rôti. But maybe that's not the case. I don't know.
Yeah, you might be right. Because I think that it would seem weird to have champagne with the beef dish, like in a traditional sense. So yeah, you're probably right. Then we have sorbet.
What on earth is this?
So
the sorbet, the descriptive copy is Romaine Fantaisie and cigarette. So Roman fantasy and cigarettes.
I have no idea.
What is it? What's the Roman fantasy?
Fantasy. Man, yeah, this one's breaking my brain.
And they're just passing around cigarettes during this with the sorbet. I don't Is that what's happening?
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, I can't wrap my head around this one. Like, Roman fantasy must be some sort of like palate cleansing something, and it's just like a specific thing, and I just don't have the context for it or something. And then, yeah, maybe you're allowed to have a cigarette, like everybody smokes or something, and so you just, you know, now is the time when you take a smoke break during the meal. It's like a palate cleanser.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I don't know. They hand them out. Do you bring them with you? I have no idea. Next course, roti, so the roast, like you were saying, is canard de tête rouge, salade de laitue, and it's served with a wine that you were talking about. So we have what would be translated as red-headed duck and lettuce salad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I don't
and
know.
And then if... this wine is Pontet Camé. Do you know what that is?
I do, actually. It's a Pauillac. So it's a famous left bank Bordeaux based on Cabernet Sauvignon. And yeah, from a fancy estate, Pontet Camé is one of the chateaus that was part of this very famous 1855 classification that like ranked all of the Bordeaux chateaux. So yeah, they're drinking fancy Bordeaux.
Fancy Bordeaux. I mean, definitely makes sense that would go with the roast. I don't know how you would have it with your Roman fantasy, but... And then we have dessert. So last course is the sweet course.
Okay, and I'm so curious about the French here. Like the first part of dessert is petit moule fantaisie again. But moule to me is mussels, like seafood.
Yeah.
But what is 100%. It must mean something else here, obviously.
I don't know. I mean, yeah, it certainly translates as mussels. So it's got to be... Like, I don't know. Yeah, maybe they look like mussels. Like,
right,
maybe
like
fantasy is like, the idea is that like something is presented as something else. So maybe it looks like mussels, but it's actually like, I don't know, little meringues or something. I don't know.
But then we get into, we were talking when I was reading you the French Laundry menu where like the dessert just says like assorted mignardises or something, but it's actually like 40 different things. And it's the same thing here, I imagine, like, because after the moule, it says gâteau assorti, bonbon, petit four, and fruits assortis. So it's just like it's cakes, treats.
Assorted fruits, assorted cakes, candies, and petit fours.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, maybe it's a cart or something.
Right.
And then after that, we have a cheese course, fromage, and it is Roquefort et Camembert.
Yum.
So Roquefort and Camembert.
Mm-hmm.
And then café.
Yeah.
And then Apollinari. I don't know what that is.
It's actually it's a mineral water or like a spring water from somewhere in Germany.
Oh, from like that's the name of the place that it's from.
Yeah.
Gotcha. How do you know that?
You've been
in France once, so
there's
I suppose
a famous it comes from like a famous bath in Germany.
Oh. Interesting. So, yeah,
you can go there and swim in this water, or you can buy bottles of it and drink.
Like unswommen.
I don't know. Yeah, we'll see.
And then we have cognac, cordials, and cigars.
Excellent.
So, you know, you get a cigarette break. Maybe like normally you would just smoke a cigar, but like if it's during the meal, that's when you would have a cigarette. I don't know too much about smoking culture, but maybe back then it was quite different.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, yeah, this is a really interesting menu. I'm really curious about the mussel thing. Really curious about the Roman fantasies thing. I think that it's maybe going to require a little bit of follow-up, maybe a little bit of research.
Mm-hmm.
Go and see if I can dig up some things. I mean, if this is at the World's Fair, I'm sure there was press about it. I wonder if there's other information about this menu or this meal or something somewhere that we could dig up.
Mm-hmm.
I'd be curious to find out more information about it. Anyway, Spencer, thanks for sending it in. If you see any other niche menus or you're flipping through books and you see old weird menus, like I'm super curious about them. It's really interesting to like break them down and think about what it would have been like to eat like historical menus. Like, I don't know, like I'm not that great at imagining history generally, but for food history, I have enough context that I can like, you know, sort of, I think, put myself a little bit better in like time and place and imagine maybe a little bit what it would have been like. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of probably my imaginings are like influenced by like movies that I've seen where they have like old food presentations and stuff like that as well.
Right.
But I, you know, I've looked at enough like drawn pictures of food in like really old cookbooks and things like that. And read enough about like historical food to sort of like have a bit of context. And so it's interesting for me to think about like what it would be like to sit around a big table and have this meal served to you.
Mm-hmm.
It's also interesting, like I wonder how exclusive it is or was to like have these wines and these champagnes and stuff like in Chicago in the time that this took place. Like,
right.
Yeah, I think like, again, like if you imagine like Chicago for like, there's a lot of like movies about Chicago in like the 30s and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously there are a lot of movies that take place in sort of like this time frame in the Eastern United States and in the Western United States. But like, it seems to me that the types of things that are on this menu, especially the wines, are probably like pretty hard to come by, you know, like mm-hmm. they're probably specially imported and specially treated, you know, to bring over for this, like,
right.
And I'm also curious, like, was this a meal that was served like as something to represent France? Like, it's a world's fair, so everyone like brings their, you know, shows off what the best things are in their country, that their country has to offer. And so I wonder if this is like, you know, a meal put on by France. Hmm. Or if it's like something that was just, you know, like a part of the fair, like, you know, maybe there are like restaurants at the fair and one of them was offering this sort of like French idea, or if this is like whole, like imported whole cloth, like as like a representation of like French cuisine or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Really curious. And Spencer, I guess if you have any other context or information that you can send in about this menu, definitely curious to do a little bit of a deeper dive on it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to quickly Google Roman fantaisie romaine. See if I can find a picture or something. Fantaisie romaine. Your search, fantaisie romaine, did not match any documents. Apparently, fantaisie romaine does not exist on the internet.
I don't know if it makes any. It is. It's written as romaine fantaisie. I don't know if that makes any difference.
Way. I got it backwards.
Yeah.
Okay. Sorry.
That's good.
I'll try again. Also, not any great matches. Okay. Well, that doesn't. I feel like that doesn't leave much hope for the mussels. But maybe we should try that as well.
So I think that moule is also just a word for mold, like as in like a baking mold.
Oh.
And so it just means little fancy molded things.
Fair. How did you come up with that?
I Googled French word moule.
Okay.
And some stuff for molds came up.
I got you.
Well, you know what? Somebody, that's funny. When I search romaine fantaisie, I get my first result is a blog where someone cooked this menu, this exact menu.
Really?
Yes. Lessons from, again. It says, it's the blog is called Heavy Table, and it says lessons from a quote, devil in the white city feast. And it says romaine fantaisie. We feared this was a salad and were cheered to find out it was a highly alcoholic sorbet.
Oh, interesting. Why didn't that pop up when I should have copied it directly? I like typed it in. That's my problem. Oh, I did spell it correctly. That's weird. Huh? Well, there you go. Devil in the White City Feast. Wow, that's cool. Well, I guess we have a bunch of context now. I'm probably going to read this blog post before we do our next episode and we can do some follow-up about it.
Thanks for listening to Food Court, a podcast recorded in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Food Court is hosted by Alan Sutterby and Shale McDonald. theme music by Ryan and Shale McDonald. Make sure to subscribe to Food Court in Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or in your favorite podcast player. We love to hear from our listeners. Please drop us a line at feedback@foodcourt.fm or find us on Instagram at Food Court Podcast. If you want to spread the word, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We'll be back in 2 weeks with a fresh new episode. Thanks for listening.